in some sort of flight of fancy, I thought, well, okay, I'll put my pajamas on, I'll just pop into bed and just lie there still. So then, well, then I sent them away, but it was, by that time I was thinking, now you've inconvenienced everyone, so.
Yeah, as a matter of course, I try to keep
Oh, do you? Oh, just in case.
I'll save your seat.
Although here there's a rule that told me to check in that if they haven't there's a 48-hour rule, if they haven't been in your
okay, book.
To check your room, they can come in. Overexertional.
Okay. The last panel, before we took a break for lunch, dealt with questions of organizations within the Republic, private organizations that might act as counterweights to the centralizing state. Tocqueville famously describes various civic groups that Americans join and band themselves into to aid in helping themselves, to aid the government to perform services. But I think that it's clear from the discussion that we've been having that there are differing ideas about whether such organizations are actually a help or a hindrance. We see in some of the modern civic organizations that they may tend to, in some ways, to use their collective might to act as a sort of faction, which may or may not be a good idea, depending on your perspective. We've looked at a few different ideas over the last couple of days, the function and purpose of government, how it can be limited and why it should be. We still have some ambiguity over the question of whether government intervention is actually a good thing, from the point of view of utility as well as from the point of view of morality or mercy. For the final panel, we're going to look at what may be the greatest expansion of the state and central coercive authority in recent memory, the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as it's known. I can't think of anything else that has taken such a big whack at the expansion of governmental power in my life. This may actually even be larger in some ways than Great Society was. I mean, it's big. Mike, is it bigger than the Great Society? It's smaller than the Great Society. Well, it's still pretty darn big. So, a lot of help you are. Okay. The readings that we had for this panel include an article from the Hoover Institution on why the Affordable Care Act could be declared unconstitutional from the point of view of the Commerce Clause. We've got an essay by George Will, a column by George Will, on sort of continual governmental expansion, whether there is any possible end in sight to it. We also have a Wall Street Journal article on Judge Sutton's decision on one of the cases that are currently being heard by the Supreme Court. And we also have the entire text of Sutton's opinion. And finally, it closes with a chapter by our friend DeJuvenal on what he calls the myth of the solution, right? So to start the ball rolling on this last panel, let's again start with a fundamental question. Is there a problem with the delivery of health care in the United States? I have to get my pen ready. Jim. And then who else? Mike.
Jim what?
James, I should say.
I've been waiting to deliver myself of this suggestion as to the definition for limited government or the limitations on government. I'm sure this emanates from my orientation as an economist. An important part of government is to promote the pursuit of happiness. To me, that means material wealth, among other things. So I have the following suggestion. Government should be limited to two things: reducing instances of market failure. And ways in which it could do this are two: to expand the definition of rights of private property. For example, one of the reasons we have a problem with pollution is that we don't have well-defined property rights in the environment. And to decrease costs of transactions. Government has done has done an excellent job there, I think, by providing for clear titles and for providing a reasonable predictability of litigation. Now, with that in mind, I'd like to draw attention to page 2 of 7 in the article by Richard Epstein. I think that's the, if you start at the very beginning of the readings for this section, there's a part of the Washington Post that's 2 or 3 pages, and then Epstein, and on page 2 of 7. Look at the central paragraph there. It starts with the phrase, from its dubious premise, and goes on in line 3, about the middle of line 3. Congress should be free to forge, emphasis mine, national solutions to national problems, no matter how local or seemingly passive, and so on. Obviously, the provision for national defense is a national problem. The markets, we've pointed out, will not deliver that. I fail to see how the provision of health care or food or diet sodas is a national problem. Health care is certainly much more important than diet sodas. But I think there's no reason to conclude that markets left to their own, which means property in health care policies, interstate competition, and a reforming of the tort laws with regard to medical malpractice, fail to see why private markets will not provide a solution to that problem. Now, it might well be that given recent changes in medical technology, average incomes or incomes for the lower quintile, if you will, are not sufficient to provide the level of health care that we would like people to have. The answer to that, for me, is to provide a minimum guaranteed income and then, as a libertarian, allow the people to spend that income as they choose. If they choose not to spend it on health care, that should be their right. And with that, I conclude.
So let me get this right. You are saying a minimum basic income to be provided by the state?
Instead of all the state... Is this going?
Yes.
Instead of... Did you cut me out?
No.
Instead of all the safety nets that we have, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, unemployment insurance, and God knows what else. Charles Murray is out of our hands. That book.
Okay.
In our hands, right?
In our hands.
There's something to do with our hands, but okay. Okay, I am nonplussed.
In their hands, not their problems in my hands.
I'm just nonplussed, James. I never thought that I would ever hear you say the sentence that the government should provide a minimum income for any reason.
But let me defend that for just a moment. Once again, I believe that I got a really lucky draw from the gene pool. And there's a part of me that says, I don't know whether the word is right, it's fair. I don't want the word fair. It's desirable that those who did not get nearly as lucky a draw have some of the same opportunities that I have. I think it is horribly inefficient to deliver those opportunities as we're doing it now. And a guaranteed minimum income with the recipients left to spend it as they please, and with the abolition, this is Murray's idea, with the abolition of all these nanny state type welfare safety net problems abolished.
Okay.
I don't throw Granny out in the snowbank, Chris.
I'm glad to hear that. Mike.
By the way, if you look at the 1928 Communist Party 10 principles, that would be the first one in it.
Right.
I know. That's what's so extraordinary about this day. We've really come to a breakthrough here.
Yes,
I'm at
the turning stone this year.
And also for everyone, Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek, and also Charles Murray have supported this idea, as probably does this guy. But that's beside the point. I want to talk. You asked the question, what's up with healthcare?
I did ask a question.
Let me try to lay out a little bit, because otherwise this turns into a long lecture. One question to ask whether it's okay, is it working, is if I ask anyone in this room, would you be willing to go back right now to have 1981 healthcare at 1981 prices? Raise your hand if you'd like that.
In index dollars or in real
dollars? We'll do index dollars. The quality of care you got in 1981 at 1981 prices, you guys would.
What do you mean by quality?
Well, right. I'm going to leave it opaque because that's one of the problems we have here in the discussion.
Technology.
Right. Right.
Well, that's what I mean. The fact that a few of you raised your hand, to your credit, but the fact that nobody raised their hand tells me that we're kind of getting a good deal right now. Second, in terms of sort of how big it is, Chris asked me, like, whoa, what's going on? How big is this? Again, the worst case estimates of the additional cost, ignore the, for the time being, the imposition on our liberty, the cost of Obamacare, $1 trillion over 10 years, say. So it's $100 billion a year. Just to put it in perspective, Medicare is spending over $500 billion a year right now. Social Security is trillion. $500 billion. Medicare is spending almost $250 billion. You know, it's still smaller than those, not to put, you know, compare it to the two. But the problem, you asked what the problem was.
Is there a problem?
Well, the perceived problem. I don't believe there's a problem. We have a hard time distinguishing expenditures on something from true costs, and there's nothing that irks me more in these debates when someone confuses. We spend 17% of GDP on healthcare. That's not the same as saying it's really costly. It could be vastly understating the cost. It could be vastly overstating the cost. And I can follow up later. But here's the deal. Right now, we do spend about 17% of GDP, 18% depending on how you measure it, on healthcare. And there are about 45 to 50 million Americans, which at any one point in time don't have health insurance during the year. Does that mean they all never get it? No. Of that pool, something about a third of them never have health insurance during the year. And so the argument for health reform comes from two areas, and then I'll invoke the market failure one. One is, well, look, we're really rich, and we don't need to live in a world where someone's at just complete risk from a health thing ruining their life. And remember, this argument didn't happen in 1928. What is it? Anyone remember Herbert Hoover's famous campaign line? Yeah, chicken in every pot, right? And so how far we've come now when we're talking about giving health care to everybody. So that's a testament that, you know, 100% of Americans were uninsured in 1928. Today, it's about 16%. That number has been steadily declining. It seems to have leveled a little bit. But the other thing that we all know is, and you know, we do spend a lot, and if you look at other countries, modern Western rich democracies, we don't seem to get better outcomes. Now, I can tweak the numbers to make you believe otherwise. I can. If I risk adjust the data, the fact is more Americans jump out of airplanes and bungee jump than people in Europe. And we save more babies than people anywhere in the world. Once I control for that, our outcomes are number one. Depending on the measure, mortality, for example. So again, I've not gotten to a game of, and clearly, like, there's some inefficiencies there. And you might say, is it all due to our wealth? No. If you gave Germany American-level wealth, they'd still spend less than 16-17% of GDP. They'd get closer to us, but it doesn't make the whole gap up. So there's this push, like, you know, we just couldn't do better. But the economic argument comes from two places. And I'm not saying I believe them, or I just need to lay them out there. There's a true potential market failure in the delivery of health insurance. There, and I'll tell that in a second. There's a second market failure that gets created because of a government rule.
That's right.
And we'll talk about that. And then there's a third, is sort of the overarching question of, like, is there a big massive information problem in the delivery of healthcare where we have to have someone step in and intervene? And I won't address the last one. So what's the market failure argument? Why the mandate? Why would I support it as an economist? Well, the story goes something like this. You as an individual know a hell of a lot more about your health and well-being than the doctor or the insurer. Some of you may have had a cigarette between the last seminar and now. Some of you may have had a few drinks eaten a cheeseburger. And, the doctor doesn't know that. And no matter how truthfully you try to tell them that, they don't know it. The insurer doesn't know that. So you tend to, in markets where there's really a hard time getting that information across to people, see insurers have to just sort of charge you a premium. That's the average of the risk of everyone in the population. So suppose we all pay $1,000 a month premium. So that's $12,000 a year of health insurance premiums. What that captures is the expected value of your lifetime health costs in an actuarial fair sense, right? So, like, nobody really should be getting a good deal from insurance if it's priced right. If everyone was a similar risk, you know, over the course of our lifetimes, the amount we pay in premiums to the day we die would exactly equal our lifetime health expenses. Now, again, we can talk about whether that's right. But everyone is different risk. Some people are healthier than others. And sometimes it's not really easy to see that just from even height, weight, you know, what your job is, things like that. So for those of you in the audience who are very, very healthy, who behave very well, you look at that $1,000 and say, that's a crappy deal. I know I'm only going to cost the equivalent of $500 a month. And so you opt out of the insurance market. And who's left in the insurance pool? A bunch of sicker people who are going to cost us $1,100 a month, $1,200 a month. And so what happens? The average risk of the insurance pool rises, and the true actual cost of delivering that product has gone up. So now you're the marginally healthy guy. You're like, well, you had only one cheeseburger between the last meeting and now, not two. And you're like, that's not a good deal for me either. So the story is the whole thing kind of unravels where at the end of the day, the insurers are left with only really high-risk customers paying phenomenally high premiums. And that's the quote-unquote market failure. Oh, I hate the word. And so the idea is someone can step in and do something. Now, hilariously, when you see like modern economists talking about adverse selection insurance markets, they mean the opposite. They say, well, something's wrong because the health insurers cherry-pick the sick, the healthy people. Well, they just sort of undone the argument by saying that's what happens, and now they left the realm of economics and into something else. But that's the one. And so the case might be you can regulate, you can mandate everyone gets covered so you can't drop out of the pool. In some sense, you'd have to be subsidizing those folks, even though that's not how insurance works. The second, market failure. In Massachusetts, this is Massachusetts reform. This is one of the two reasons they imposed it, was, well, look, anybody that walks into an emergency room, and you guys are all well aware of this, it's all over the news. You walk to an emergency room, you gotta get treated. Whether, you know, if you don't have health insurance, it doesn't matter. They treat you first, worry about the payments later. And the idea is, well, we all pay for that. Those of us with health insurance or those of us who are just willing to go and pay with cash. By the way, walk into an emergency room for fun and tell them, I want to pay for something with cash. Look and video the look on their face. I have a story, but again, we have to go. So the problem is, look, lots of sick people, for lack of, they don't have insurance, or they live far from their doctor. Some they use the emergency room sometimes just as a doctor's office. They just make heavy use of it, and that costs someone money. Someone pays. The typical way it's paid, and again, we know people in the industry. Private insurers typically pay more, right? So when someone with Blue Cross walks into the hospital, they're actually charged a higher rate than they otherwise would be if we weren't paying for someone else's care. The taxpayers also pay another way. Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement rates to providers end up being higher to compensate the doctors for delivering the free care. That used to happen in charity hospitals, too. So that's the second sort of argument. Well, since someone who goes into the emergency room is spilling costs onto the rest of us, well, then we should make up for it. And some people say, well, we just mandate everyone has insurance. Now, I won't go into too much more, but really quickly, what's happened in Massachusetts? We did something similar. And yes, everyone now in Massachusetts has health insurance. But economists distinguish insurance and care. You give me an insurance card, that doesn't say anything about whether I'm actually going to get a doctor to see me. So in Massachusetts, there hasn't really been a dramatic increase in access to doctors. In fact, there are fewer doctors accepting patients today in Massachusetts than there were 6 years ago when the reform passed. Secondly, and again, they're going to play bait and switch on you. I know who the hell that is. Well, maybe the uncompensated care thing. We get everyone insurance, at least we'll stop spending money on the emergency room. Well, that's true, there are fewer emergency room visits now, but expenditures on emergency rooms are higher today after the health reform than before it. And we're also contemplating now cost controls on that system because expenditures have gone up more than we anticipated. It wouldn't be a surprise. So that's sort of the economics of the thing. And you know, I haven't weighed on whether I think we should do it or not, but that sort of lays out what we're looking at here.
Jim, briefly.
I'll deal with the first two of the market failures that Mike rose. And in both, I think the problem of not letting the perfect get in the way of the best is, again, relevant here. But not letting the perfect get in the way of the good, sorry. The problem of asymmetric information is present in many, many insurance situations. Life insurance, fire insurance, liability insurance. I know what kind of a driver I am, and I know more about my driving habits and my wife's driving habits than the insurance company can easily discover. By the way, my wife has never had an accident, and I have. I know that. That doesn't prevent the auto liability insurance industry from functioning, and functioning quite well. Same thing with fire insurance. It's a lot easier for me to know whether I'm careful with the placement of fire extinguishers in my home, not storing gasoline rags in the garage, and all that sort of thing. So the fact that there's a problem with asymmetric information in the healthcare market, I think, is not dispositive. Further, I think medical technology, I'm guessing here, is probably coming a long way to enable physicians to discover less expensively just what kind of a risk I am, whether I smoke or not, whether I, how much cholesterol I have, and so on and so forth. Now, about the free rider problem, let me tell you about Mother Bernadette. Some time ago, I had problems in my chest on the left-hand side. Kept coming. We went into the emergency room two or three times, and each time I was given tests to determine whether I'd had a stroke or a heart attack. I hadn't had a heart attack. Might be a gallbladder, and so on. Went home. One time we went in, same thing. Tests. No, you're okay. I haven't had a heart attack. Had any stroke. This is in the dead of the night. Long came a nun. It was a Catholic hospital, a very fine hospital, to ask me how was I doing, and so on and so forth, and offer a little prayer, which I appreciated. And then she asked, did I have insurance? I said, oh, yes, I have my insurance. Here's my card. Then she went next door. There's only a little curtain separating my bed from the guy next door. Guy next door had rammed his motorcycle into a tree. How are you doing, and so on and so forth, and got to the point about how are you going to pay. Do you have insurance? No. And he asked, what happens if you don't have insurance? And the nun said, oh, don't worry. Mother Bernadette will take care of that. Well, at that point, I almost did have a stroke. Because Mother Bernadette was going to use her connections with the legislature in Albany to stick this kid's hand in my pocket. Now, on the way out, my wife noted that there was no indication that anyone was going to take away his motorcycle or anyone was going to impose upon him even $5 a month. Nothing. So the business of we'll have to take care of these people anyway rather than throw them out in the snowbank, and I'm not quite ready to do that. I think we could introduce some incentives for these people to take a bit more care and reduce maybe the likelihood that they might wind up in the emergency room. Even a garnish, if that's the word, on the wage of $25 a week or something like that. Something.
I'm actually curious. We'll go to Elaine and Jennifer, but I'm curious if you see a problem with the opacity of the way that healthcare is paid for almost everywhere. I do not know, most people don't know how much is actually taken out of their wages for insurance unless they really study their pay card well.
I do.
They really don't know, and it's very difficult to find out what their employers are actually paying in addition to that to the insurance companies. And you don't know what the insurance companies pay to the hospitals, which is why paying in cash, one of the reasons why paying in cash is so difficult, because they don't know what the value of anything is, because it all depends on who you are and what organization you're with. I mean, is that also not kind of a problem?
I do, and we could address that by removing health care from fringe benefit. Now, you know where health care as a fringe benefit came from.
Post-World War II, wasn't it?
That's right. Through wage and price controls. So in order to hire persons without violating the wage and price controls, you increase compensation in non-regulated forms. And that...
It's just that Mike had wanted to get in, and he did that thing with his fingers. So I
Remove... You bypass the wage and price controls by increasing compensation in the form of non-regulated benefits, such as... health insurance and life insurance. If we got rid of that, then persons would be able to purchase health insurance in the same way that we now purchase automobile insurance. Further, when I purchase automobile insurance, I select that combination of a fairly high deductible, because I have low-value automobiles, not fancy automobiles, and in exchange for a very high deductible for collision, I have a fairly low premium. I would like to purchase health insurance policies that will not cover the routine things, such as the sniffles and ringing in my ears and all that sort of thing. and save it for the real wipeouts, such, not wipeouts, but the major expenses such as the excision of my gallbladder.
Mike.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, Jim, I, with due respect, I mean, we can have a very long discussion about what reform could look like, but we'll be here for a long time. I just want to, you asked a question about transparency. Between 85% and 90% of the doctor's bills are paid by third parties, people other than the guy seeing the doctor. That's the highest percentage on earth, including Britain's national healthcare system. By that measure, we're the most socialized in terms of insulated from cost. Secondly, you do get at the end of the year, you might not at AHI, but if at, the, at Hamilton, you do get at the end of the year a statement that says how much your school contributed on your behalf. Nationally, you sort of see something like if you included the value of compensation into median earnings for the last 30 years, you'd see about a 35% increase. All the increases we've seen in compensation have come from non-wage compensation, not from the wage side. But you can see it. It's mandated by law that we see how much they contribute as well. But, you know, for example, U of R gives me $1,000 a month.
But okay. We don't have to have it that way.
Yeah.
Right? Anymore, we don't have collision insurance and liability insurance included in the fringe benefit.
Right. And again, that was institutionalized by Eisenhower. So even though the wage controls, the health insurance was issued because of the wage controls, it wasn't until Eisenhower said, let's give them a tax deduction for it, that became institutionalized. So it did come a little after that when the choice.
I think if we got rid of that, we would go a long way towards solving what is stated as a national problem. Further, like I say, just because something costs a great deal of money doesn't mean that the market won't handle it. Whether or not the market will handle it depends on the type of good, as you well know. Health insurance is not a public good. National defense is.
Elaine.
You can include we could have the people who don't pay for their gallbladders to be taken out, don't have their gallbladders taken out, and they deal with the discomfort.
I want to thank Jim for actually dealing with part of what I wanted to say, which is to remind people that the reason that America, the healthcare delivery system in America is in such a mess, and my answer to your first question is simply, yes, there is a problem, is that this is a response to previous government interventions. There is an historical reason how this came about, and it is very much due to government intervention in the free market. And as mentioned earlier, I think it does matter how problems arose when we're trying to analyze exactly what's wrong and how best to deal with them. I'm very surprised to hear you say that there's a higher reimbursement rate here than in Britain, because I spent almost all of my adult life living under the national health system in Britain, and it is a system where there is explicit rationing. Now, the rationing is typically done not by presenting a ration book, a coupon book at the doctor's office. It's done by postcode, by zip code, as it were, depending on where you live and what time of the year it is, whether or not the locality in which you happen to be registered has used up its budget for the particular kind of illness to which you might succumb. And if it turns out you're too late in the year in the queue, well, you just get pushed to the next year. And if it's the sort of thing that you die from in between, well, that's rather sad. It is also the case that, this was a scandal in Britain, even in Britain, that there are hospitals that put an automatic default DNR for anyone over the age of 50, 5-0. Think about that. Do not resuscitate if you're over the age of 50. Bit frightening, that, even if you're not yet 50. If you're over 50, it's even more concerning. There are also far fewer doctors per population in Britain. Not surprising, because it's not nearly as lucrative a profession, and the demands that are put upon clinicians are really very substantial in terms of the kinds of paperwork and the like, which are now also afflicting American doctors. The other thing that surprised me very much in what Mike said was the low cost that he attributed to Obamacare. And I think one of the reasons why the published stats appear to show that as a low cost is that the kinds of savings that are presupposed in those budgetings are based on studies that are at best highly debatable, and at worst, simply presuppose denying care to the most vulnerable parties in society, those who are very old, those who are very ill, those who lack the social support networks the underclass, one might call them. And these are the sort of the Wenberg research and the Dartmouth Health Atlas and the like. They based the methodology that they used was very, very flawed and came from examining the comparative costs for health care in the last 2 years of life for people with a set of fairly dire diagnoses. And the problem was that instead of studying the outcomes of people, looking at people at a particular fixed date and then seeing how they fared 2 years on, they worked backwards. And they assumed that since they were starting with the fact that all of the patients had died, they must all have had the same diagnosis at the outset and must all have had the same level of disease at the outset. And that's patently false, because not all diseases, even with the same name, proceed at the same rate with everyone. It matters, for example, when your cancer is discovered, what your likelihood of recovery is. They also made the mistake of thinking that simply because some areas were larger and were urban and had lots of people in them, the mere fact that there were more deaths in those areas meant that they could assume that the outcomes were necessarily worse. Whereas they didn't take into account the fact that there were more gradations of disease. I mean, I won't go into the details of the study right now. The point is that the estimates of the financial cost, the pure economic cost of Obamacare are, I suspect, greatly underestimated. And then there are also other economic costs, independent of simply the original outlay, in terms of, for example, the number of doctors that there are likely to be. Most of the doctors I know who are anywhere near retirement age are planning to cease to practice because they do not wish to be involved in the system. The amount of interference with their clinical choices is going to be really very substantial. Again, let us look at the British example. There's a thing that they've been advocating with an attempt to reduce the costs, what is called evidence-based medicine. And this sounds wonderful. Let's examine the scientific evidence as to what sorts of treatments are the most efficacious for actually curing people or reducing their misery or improving their quality of life during their remaining lifespan. Sounds like a really good idea, and it is, on the whole, on average, and for statistical aggregates. The problem is that individuals respond differently. On the basis of this, something called the National Institutes of Clinical Excellence, NICE, good acronym for that, isn't it, has specified which treatments are to be allowed through the national health care and which are not. Only the most efficacious are allowed because they're trying to get, quite reasonably, the most beneficial outcome per unit of expenditure. It's a quite sensible kind of objective to have. The problem is that they then ban all of the others. And so, for example, if you happen not to be one of the patients who fit the profile that is best suited by the approved medication, and you then want, even privately, out of your own pocket, to buy the medication that's not on the NICE list, you are then banned from getting any national health care in future. Full stop. Don't tell you about that one. And it is certainly the case that although it may be in statistical aggregates, most patients will benefit from treatment A, there are going to be any number of patients who aren't like that. Physiologies are very different. People are individuals. And what will work for one patient isn't necessarily the best, and this is where clinical judgment comes in. This is where the doctor's expertise really enters into it. Why, it's not simply enough to look it up on the web, but you need someone who's got the experience and the particular understanding of how these things work, and you can put together the various ailments you have, and nobody else has, in quite that combination, in quite that degree, to work out a pattern of treatment that might be likely to actually improve your health and your quality of life. And that is what is going to be restricted under Obamacare, even before we get to the problem of the mandates and the like. I'll stop right now. You can imagine I object to those on libertarian grounds.
I'm going to go to Jennifer next and then back to Mike.
So I just wanted to make one point, that the asymmetric information problem with healthcare is more difficult than it is with car insurance, mainly because the effects of behavior carry over for many longer years. The variance in risk is much greater and much harder to identify, really, than for car insurance. Unfortunately, I'm still going to be with the panel. I know that it's not my role, but way to deal with asymmetric information problems is to basically segregate the market, not to group it all into one big average. So if you want to deal with asymmetric information problems in car insurance and you segregate the market, you know, you have 18 to 25-year-old males, right? They're their own risk pool. They pay more than everyone else because they're more dangerous drivers than everyone else, right? And once you've done that, then you've reduced the variance between the high-risk drivers in the pool and the very low-risk drivers in the pool, which helps with that asymmetric information so people don't jump out of the pool, right? So with health insurance, the way, again, to reduce the problem would be to segregate the market as opposed to pulling it all into one big risk pool. And the weird thing, besides the fact that we don't purchase our own health services, which is a big problem with healthcare, the other weird thing is that our risk pools are not that have nothing to do at all with the characteristics that make us have certain health risks, right? So what are our risk pools? They're our employers. So I don't get pooled for my insurance with a bunch of other, 30-year-old mothers, right, and have to pay that kind of premium. I get pooled with my company, right, with my college. And so what happens is that I basically pay an average that's associated with the average, cost associated with my college, and I'm subsidizing right now those people who are older and, sicker. Excuse me. So, and when I get older and sicker, the young colleagues are going to subsidize me, right? So we already have a system, actually, that's very kind of similar to the nationalized healthcare system, but just on a decentralized ground right now, while going through our employers. So I agree with Jim that not having health insurance through employers is going to be a huge help to solve this problem. But I will say that the one argument that no one's brought up here as to why the cost of health insurance might go down if we have nationalized health insurance, and this is the one that you're going to find resonates most with those on the left who are really happy about the idea, is bargaining power, right? So, the cost of drugs, the cost of various surgeries and so forth and so on are, people claim, inflated because health insurance companies are profiting off of our inability to bargain as weak little individuals, right? So if the government's in control of this, then they have a huge might of the government in their bargaining power situation, and they can reduce or redistribute some of those profits that are going to health insurance companies and put them back into our rightful pockets. So I'm not sure that makes any sense, but it is probably the one question that we need to address, because that's probably the only one that is coming close to making any sense at all, maybe.
Mike and then Jim.
I'll try to be quick. I want to be clear what's in the Obamacare Act versus what we think is in the Act. There isn't, as it stands, when we say we're going to do evidence-based medicine, this funding to sort of study evidence-based medicine. Now, sure, maybe we think the slope is slippery, we may end up in that place. But right now, it's not in the Act, where we're going to have to get Medicaid dollars, practice evidence-based medicine. There's a lot of funding for the other stuff. When I quoted the $100 billion a year, I actually used the estimates that you're telling me to. So I can actually say, oh, it's going to be profitable, like the Obama administration thinks. So it's kind of a middle-of-the-ground estimate of what it might cost. Third, I mean, the other problem, again, is on the bargaining power thing, there's not a lot in this current form of the legislation that has the government doing a lot of bargaining power. They're setting up regional insurance exchanges where we can go and purchase our insurance. Beyond that, this is the debate we should be having. There's a lot we don't freaking know about the damn bill, which is the point of passing it. So we don't know what it's going to look like, and that's the debate we ought to have. I mean, there's a million ways we will all agree to better reform the healthcare system. It's obvious. But I think we should talk about what's problematic about the process. And then finally, the other thing that's causing all this stuff in medicine is high technology, sort of questionable use of low benefit but very convenient procedures. And that's always going to be with us. We're running that horse race for a long time, and it's only going to be more of a problem. We're not going to solve it. And we have to deal with how we want to do that in the future when we're all going to live to 90 and we could get another year if we did a $1 million procedure, and it's out there. What are our obligations? That's why I asked the question about 1981 healthcare at 1980 prices. We had a different set of choices we're going to be facing. And the issue really is we've got a fundamental lack of savings problem for things that Jim has mentioned that aren't really insurable. I know I'm going to spend this money over my lifetime. I don't know when, but I know in my last 2 years of life, 80% of my lifetime health expenditure is going to happen. I tell you that. So no one's forcing me to save now. And I know I'm going to have to do it. And I'd be stupid to save myself because there's a government plan out there for me when I get old. But that's another thing that's just not discussed, not accommodated for in this legislation either. Singapore does it.
I would just, before we jump in, Joe, I also believe that the problem of technology and the expense, you know, that continues to rise for especially things like end-of-life care, but other stuff as well. People say that we have a Cadillac-type healthcare system. You know, we're paying for a Cadillac healthcare system, but we have a Cadillac healthcare system. We really, really do. It's astounding what advances they've made in the last 20 years have been, and they cost money. There's just no two ways around it. Jim.
I'm appalled to hear from Mike that he hasn't read all 2,700 pages of the...
I bet he got through half of them.
After all, if Nancy Pelosi read it, why wouldn't she? With regard to Jen's point about the government using bargaining power, if we permit interstate competition among healthcare insurance companies, each of those companies will have a very strong incentive to bargain with pharmaceutical producers. And I would rather trust the competition among large healthcare insurers than I would trust the government. Further, the cost of an automobile today is much higher, even corrected for inflation, than the Model A that my father had. But quality adjusted, the cost of the automobile is probably not nearly as high. Today's automobile does things, anti-lock brakes and fuel injection and so on and so forth, that my father's automobile did not do. Now, the fact that we have a Cadillac healthcare system, just as we have Cadillac and Porsche and BMW automobiles, doesn't mean I have to buy on the high end or that anyone has to buy on the high end. I can trade off. I want the opportunity to trade off. Further, as I grow older, it's unlikely that I will have get into situations where, now notice I will not use the word need, when I will want to purchase better health care. I'm an intelligent person. I think most persons are intelligent enough to know in their very early years that the time will come when they might want to purchase these things. And I think it's up to them as free and responsible individuals to do the saving ahead of time rather than show up in the final stages of their life and ask me to pick it up.
It's a good point to kind of segue.
In short, I do not think it is a national problem
to segue
that markets won't handle.
Next thing that I wanted to bring up, which is the constitutionality of it. As you say, you want the choice, and this is precisely the issue, precisely one of the issues with the Affordable Care Act, is the ability of people to opt out of it in one way or another, whether or not that's possible. Can the government decree that you will buy something? Will the bill pass constitutional muster? I know that none of us are sitting on the Supreme Court at the moment. But, you know, from the informed panel here, what do you think? Elaine.
I think that the question, will the bill pass muster the Supreme Court and is the bill constitutional, are quite separate questions. And I wouldn't necessarily want to infer an answer to the first from the answer to the second. I think it's clearly unconstitutional insofar as the aim of the founders and the aim of the Constitution was in any way to limit government. Then this is clearly an example of unlimited government gone to the furthest extreme. just very briefly, in terms of bargaining power, the act as it stands is an imponderable. We don't really know what's in it. That's been made clear. But working through what is likely to happen in terms of the way markets operate, this is almost most likely to end up with a single purchaser and a single provider. That's not increased competition, that's monopoly on both sides, and therefore putting people everywhere in America at the total mercy of this single provider, the government.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about the constitutionality of it. I'm not a great fan of the Affordable Health Care Act, and I think one of the biggest problems is we don't know exactly what it means. I was surprised to learn in the course of watching the news about the Supreme Court oral arguments was that the Affordable Health Care Act actually has three parts to it. One is the individual mandate for people who are not covered. The second is the expansion of Medicaid to some working poor. And the third part is insurance exchange pools. So the Supreme Court is really only ruling about the first part, the individual mandate part. And there the debate is about the precise meaning of the Interstate Commerce Clause, that Congress has the power to regulate commerce among the several states. And there the technical debate turns on the word regulate. That is to say, are they regulating an already existing commerce, or are they creating commerce by mandating it? And there I could see the debate going either way. And then there was some debate about whether or not the penalty for violating is it a tax or is it a fine or a penalty? And that's, I think, pretty clearly a fine or a penalty, not a tax. So I think it's going to be a very close call. I was surprised in listening to the oral arguments that it sent shockwaves through Washington, was my understanding, that when the public in Washington was listening to the oral arguments, they were surprised that it looks like it's tipping 5-4 against or overruling, declaring it the individual mandate declaring it unconstitutional by a 5-4 margin, whereas most people going into the oral arguments thought it would be a 6-3 decision in favor of upholding it. So it looks like it's going to be very, very close. Many people say it's going to turn on Anthony Kennedy's judgment on the matter. In the oral arguments, he seemed to be leaning in favor of declaring it unconstitutional. We won't know until June. And my own personal opinion on it is that it's a really, really close call. I could see how regulating commerce, this could be considered regulating commerce if you want to see the word regulating as in, you know, perhaps, you know, bringing more commerce into being or whatever. But I can also see the argument that, in a sense, they're creating commerce by requiring people to buy an insurance policy that they might not otherwise get. So I think it's a very close call. Probably will go 5-4 in favor of declaring it unconstitutional. Then the question will be whether or not that will bring down the entire law, which Scalia said it probably would. If 1/3 of it is declared unconstitutional, the rest of it will go too. That may or may not be the case. I think we're going to wind up with a close call, probably against it, in a very muddled and confused situation, which will only be resolved in the 2012 elections, depending on, you know, who the next president is and what Congress looks like. So, I mean, I don't agree with you that it's clearly unconstitutional by any means. I mean, it could go either way. And you know, we have 4 conservatives and 4 liberals and 1 in the middle, and we'll see.
Sorry, I said I was unclear. Sorry, I'd made no prediction about what the court would say.
No,
I said it was unconstitutional,
right,
which
right,
is a different
right,
matter.
Right. No, you said your personal opinion
not
was clearly unconstitutional.
Yes.
Yep. My personal opinion, I'm not a constitutional law expert. I'm a constitutional law amateur. And it seems to me, from an amateur, a reasonable citizen's point of view, it's not clearly unconstitutional, but I could see how a reasonable argument could be developed by in which it says it is unconstitutional, but I don't think it's clear. It's no slam dunk.
Do you think that there's any traction to what's going on with the sort of organized church resistance to this, not on the grounds of commerce, which seems to be what the Supremes were focusing their questions on, but on the grounds of First Amendment, that you can't force someone to do something that is against their faith. I want to ask Adam this question.
Yeah, go ahead. He's I mean, it relates to a comment I made earlier, but he's an expert on these matters. Go ahead.
Putting that part aside, I have a lot of opinions about the First Amendment part of forcing a religious organization to participate in providing resources for people to have things and do things that they feel are against the theology and basic identity of men and women in their religion. And if one of the arguments for the existence of the market is that everyone gets old and dies if they're lucky, otherwise they just die, and therefore everyone is in some kind of the healthcare market at the end of their life, somehow that's very different from all of the rest of the things that are in that basket of health insurance benefits. And I might be able to be persuaded that there's a market at end of life, but to say that all of the rest of the package has to be bought and offered by all the insurance companies according to DHHS is a completely different kind of question, and that's where I can't go.
Do you think that there would be a court challenge could happen over this particular issue, assuming that it was sustained on commerce grounds? Could they go back at it and say you can't do this because this is a matter of conscience?
Well, I think there are already lawsuits that have been filed.
They have. I didn't know. Okay.
I think
assuming that there is a problem with healthcare, assuming. What sorts of solutions might be crafted that would stay within the Constitution? Is there anything that they can do? Is it possible to craft a single-payer system and have it be sustained constitutionally? And what about the concept of, well, are there any other suggestions that you would have to try and get around this problem?
Just gone with a voucher, sort of the equivalent of food stamps, you know, offer $5,000 at a voucher to people who are uninsured, you know, and then raise taxes to pay for it. I mean, that would be a normal way of doing business, you know. That was my preferred position, along with a little bit of tort reform and a little bit of interstate competition. Those three things probably would have solved the problems.
Is there anybody who's suggesting that who's on the national stage right now? I mean, that is one of the most annoying parts of this whole debate is I don't know who on the right is articulating any kind of position that sure makes sense.
That's very close to Paul Ryan's plan.
What?
What you suggested.
A voucher system,
right.
A tort reform.
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
sure.
That's a reasonable.
Sure.
I mean, I don't always agree with him, but it's a very, reasonable.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we cleared that up. How about the concept of health savings accounts? Would this also help to alleviate the problem? Elaine beat you to it. So
I understand that the Obamacare is going to be eliminating the possibility of the health savings accounts.
Really?
I have one now. I mean, I'm one of those rare people who is not insured through an employer because I spent most of my life overseas and was not a part of the American system. When I came back and I was not an employee of any organization, I had to go out into the market and buy medical insurance for myself with no medical record and, you know, albeit at an advanced age, but still relatively healthy, having lived in this country for many years without any U.S. medical insurance, never having had occasion to see a doctor. I had to go out into the market and buy medical insurance. I decided that the health savings account looked like a good deal, because one could then, with a very high deductible policy, get ostensibly reduced rates. And so I've done that, and I've been led to believe that if Obamacare goes in, that option will no longer be available.
I also have a health savings account, and I was under the impression that that had been upheld, that they kept it, that they tried to knock it out at one point during the bill, but it was retained later. And somewhere in the 2,700 pages, it says that it's still there.
We'll see. One little reform I'd recommend is that no vote be allowed on a piece of legislation until everyone had read it. Perhaps taken a small quiz on it. I have a very much more radical suggestion to make as well, but goes beyond healthcare, which is that you deny the franchise to anyone who is in receipt of a government transfer payment at all, including mortgage insurance relief,
right,
including student grants, including Medicaid, including Medicare, including unemployment insurance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That might solve the problem of the tyranny of the majority.
I think you might need a constitutional amendment for that one.
Yes, I agree. That's why I didn't propose that. It's within the but that's my constitutional amendment.
Okay, we've got 15 minutes left for panel discussion before questions. I thought I might take this opportunity to just ask you to sum up, now that we're at the end of 2 days of discussing, what is the problem of limited government and can the problem of limited government be solved? So take a couple of minutes and go in any order that you want. But I would like to hear from all of you. Elaine.
Well, start off again. I think the problem of limited government is that government is not sufficiently limited. That government is, by its nature, both simply as a human institution and as an institution that is manned by people who want power, who like power, who seek power, is inevitably bound to grow and try to take over as many areas as it possibly can. Greed for power is an extraordinarily dangerous vice. Unlike greed for money, which is self-correcting, greed for power tends not to be. It's self-fulfilling, and it feeds upon what fuels it. And we've seen through various analyses some of the institutional and other kinds of barriers there are to impeding the growth of government. But it is immensely dangerous, both in terms of the inefficiencies it imposes in economic or financial terms, but even more so in terms of the limitations on human freedom, freedom that is itself a precondition of virtuous activity. If you want human flourishing, this is not the sort of thing that can be given you by anyone else. Neither virtue, nor flourishing, nor happiness is something that other people can bestow upon you because it's a function of human activity. It's something you have to do for yourself. And if your action is limited by coercive intervention, by government, or indeed by your fellow citizens, then your opportunities to flourish are limited. And I would suggest that the most important defense of individual liberty comes from its essential role as a constituent element of, as well as being instrumental to, achieving flourishing for human beings.
I'd like to agree very strongly with what Elaine just said and perhaps supplement it with the following idea. I think that the citizenry has been sold on the idea that anything that is very expensive is something that markets will not provide. Homes, healthcare, college education, provision for retirement, those things are all very, very expensive, and the markets will not provide for them the way the markets will provide cans of diet soda. I think there's an educational failure there. And once the polity believes that those expensive items will not be provided by the market, then the natural, the default position is to rely on government, and then you trigger exactly the kinds of things that Elaine has so eloquently described.
Charlie, go ahead.
Just following up on Elaine's comment, I think there are certain parts of the government that are, they exist for their own growth, essentially. Many of the bureaucracies are incentivized to simply keep growing over time, and it could be argued reasonably, I think, that government by nature, or government is of the same nature. I think in terms of limiting it, the only practical thing I can think of is being limited by necessity. The keynote speaker on the first night mentioned that the unfunded liabilities in the United States are over $100 trillion. I hadn't heard $130 trillion before. But that's equal to every piece of capital in the United States of America. That includes the clothes we're wearing, every single car, table, water glass. You could sell it all if you could find a willing buyer and not be able to pay for the $100 trillion in liabilities. One of the reasons I think that only necessity can limit the government is a feedback problem. We don't really know what it costs. When we spend money, it's not with a proportional raise in taxes. We borrow a lot of it, and then we pay interest on that, so we're not even paying on the principal. We're also, and this is just another radical comment, but it's also true. We're talking about an institution that has been responsible for the deaths of, outside of wars and outside of civil wars, an institution that has been responsible for the deaths of 170 million people in the 20th century in the pursuit of its own preservation. So it's not something that's going to happen easily and probably only by necessity.
Charlie, I'm not sure what you're referring to.
There's a book by R.J. Rummel called Death by Government. It's governments acting in their self-interest to control their populace. It includes things like genocide, the Soviet gulag, and so forth.
Okay. Bob.
Okay. Yes, my summary remarks are inspired by a conversation I had over lunch with Fred Diddle when we were talking about the meaning of the word limits and limitation. So this is a brief philosophical and spiritual reflection on the meaning of the word limit or limitation. Three senses of the word limited government. The first sense is limited powers, meaning government should be limited to protecting ordered liberty, which includes personal freedom, but it also includes security, and it also includes a minimum of moral virtue. So the first meaning of the word limited is simply limited powers. The second is more philosophical, limitation by the imperfections of human nature. There really is something called human nature. We're not just constructed. And human nature is imperfect. It's fallen. It's flawed. Therefore, government should be, we should always keep that in mind when we design programs, but also when we just think of government as such. It's a fallible and corruptible instrument which is necessary and can do many good things, but will always be imperfect, and therefore it should be limited. The third sense is what Fred and I were talking about over lunch, and that is, which we haven't really talked about at all, is that we have to think about politics as a whole in relationship to the transcendent realm, by which we mean everything that goes above and beyond politics. Meaning the spiritual life of man, the artistic life of man, the philosophical life of man. Most of that cannot even be touched by politics. So the most important sense in which we should think of limited government is it doesn't deal with the most important things in our lives, our souls, our minds, our spirits, and eternal life, ultimately. So, in the last analysis, it's kind of a reflection on St. Augustine's distinction between the city of God and the city of man. And the city of man will never really ultimately really touch upon the city of God. And I think that's the most important limitation on government.
Adam.
What I say when I talk to undergrads is that how important the First Amendment is, that the government has said that there is one place where it's not going to go, and that's into our own minds and conscience. And tell us that if we have the wrong thoughts, we'll be punished. At least that's the one place the government has said, not going there. But in every other way, almost every other way, the government says, in terms of conduct, we can pretty much tell you what to do and not to do, especially in the Obamacare context. And so since we're doing modest proposals and constitutional amendments, maybe talking about the Commerce Clause is a problem from the beginning. It's not totally clear to me why the government needs to be in charge of telling us anything about our individual conduct, and maybe not even telling us about our interpersonal conduct.
Mike?
Sorry. The problem I see is that governments, in my view, evolved very much in the lines of Hayek's spontaneous orders elsewhere, and that we don't really have the knowledge to restrain or adjust it and have any idea whether our efforts to do so are going to produce the consequences that we hope for them to have. So I suggest we be humble in the way we think about reform, which maybe means I'm going to get steamrolled one day. A second thing, of course, is, again, this is a psychology question. Dan Klein calls it the people's romance. And I don't know if it's always been the case that we treat sort of government as a secular religion or not, but to a man, my students, when I ask, is there a problem? And they say, and we all agree, yes, their first reaction is, well, government's got to solve it. I mean, the idea that there's any other institutions that could do it just as strange. So people ask me, what do you do? Like, I think we just do more. Do stuff voluntarily and ignore the state. Maybe let them take half my goddamn income. Ignore the state. That's my way of ignoring it is not to not pay my taxes. It's to demonstrate that everything we're worried that that markets can't do actually can do it, despite the difficulty. And I think sort of the bigger question is, you know, there, nowhere in this discussion do we talk about exit. You know, it's always having a better voice, being better, you know, the more we can think about exits, the better we can think about sort of putting constraints on government. And then finally, of course, in terms of the actual structure of government, we didn't get a chance to actually talk about it, was the role of the administrative agencies and the delegated powers that they have. So to me, the most powerful agency on earth is probably the FDA, and probably the second most powerful agency on earth is the EPA. Not any of you had a say on who's working there. And there's very little formal review of anything that they do. And I think that's a big, major concern I have, and I don't know how to deal with that.
Tiffany?
First, a quick comment, and then kind of a general summary. The quick comment is, in terms of the estimate of our unfunded obligations, Roger Kimball used the figure $130 trillion. Estimates vary. And when you start talking about the what is the measure of our fiscal gap. So on the low end, for example, last year, the Government Accountability Office produced a report, the long-term fiscal outlook of the United States, that suggested that our unfunded obligations, I think, into the 75-year horizon, were $99.4 trillion. That's the low end. Lawrence Kotlikoff estimates it, and I don't think he's using the exact same horizon, but his estimate is $200 trillion. It's a serious problem. The more general summary I guess I wanted to make was, and I think that a lot of the readings of the last session are kind of focusing on, we're kind of constitutionally working out, or potentially given how the Supreme Court decides on the constitutionality of Obamacare, we're really kind of constitutionally working out a transformation in our governance that has its roots about 100 or so years ago. And by that I mean the progressives were very clear, the early progressives are quite clear that the fundamental source on the of the limit on the power of government that lies in government's obligation to secure the natural rights of the individual, they're very clear. We don't believe in those rights. They are setting those aside, and they explicitly state that this means that there is, in principle, no limit on the power of government. The practical problem for them became, of course, that they had to deal with the constitutional limits in trying to implement the policies that they believed would ultimately deliver the ever-elusive utopia. Even in terms of Obamacare, the American Association of Labor Legislation, this group that was a spinoff of the American Economic Association, became the primary advocacy group for social insurance and began advocating for government-provided health insurance around 1914. The 1935 Social Security Act, it was originally intended to include a plan for health insurance. Medicare and Medicaid, that was eventually established during the Great Society period, was ultimately viewed as a piecemeal step in that direction. We're not going to get the whole thing, let's take what we can get. So Obamacare itself actually is a policy that the progressives have been seeking for about 100 years now. And the other important, and clearly, and the point is that these kind of policies don't coexist very well with the idea of limited constitutional power. So we're really at, I think, an important turning point in terms of, as some of the readings suggested, and as some of the federal judges who have handed down decisions in these cases, well, are we saying there are no limits on the Commerce Clause, on government's powers under the Commerce Clause? And some of them are acknowledging, yes. Okay, so constitutionally, we may be passing an important point here. The other aspect that I wanted to come back to and that Mike has mentioned and that I think is important to emphasize is that this transformation in our governance not only has unleashed the scope of government power and involving government in a whole host of areas it previously was not involved in, but the very way in which policy is made, the way in which regulations are made. There's been a profound change in the policymaking process. And so the progressives were very clear that at the root of the positive state, that the implementation of the positive state, the expanded government activity, would necessitate the congressional delegation of power and the turn to administrative policymaking, so that the overwhelming majority of federal rules today are never even passed on by the House, the Senate, presented to the President. They sidestep that constitutional legislative process. And they are, at best, made by the bureaucrats, the civil servants in the administrative agencies, and frankly, in a number of areas, it's not even the bureaucrats who are actually making the decisions. It's the interests who are supposed to be being regulated. But most Americans don't know that those rules, when they go into effect, they don't go back through the constitutional legislative process. We have significantly set that aside and thus stripped ourselves of all the protections to liberty built into that process. The representative principle, separation of powers, bicameralism, we've set those significantly aside, and I think that's worth considering.
That's excellent. Pamela.